Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
There's separate issues here. I think whether or not LeBron should or will sit is a conversation that's not unworthy and that probably should get had at some point. And you're certainly right about ESPN's history and what they tend to focus on. And generally speaking, although I find it annoying sometimes as a fan largely of teams that are not included, I get it. They're trying to draw in the largest possible audience by appealing to the widest base of sports fans. And many, many, many more people know who LeBron James is than who Kentavious Caldwell-Pope is, even though they both play on the same team. That's just the way the sports media world works, particularly in this country. It's frustrating, but understandable. What I do not understand, and what I think is a little bit beyond just ESPN's modus operandi and more a sign of the way NBA coverage has been tilted over the last 5 years, is that instead of even pretending to do a post-game show about the game, or if you want to spin it forward, to talk about how the performances of two of the league's premier players on one of its premier teams, all things you're supposed to be talking about, actually did in the basketball. Because here's what those guys did in the basketball. They combined for 64 points, 20 rebounds, 13 assists, 5 steals, and 2 blocks between the two of them, and shot over 50% from the field. That's worthy of discussion. What they're going to be able to do in the playoffs is worthy of discussion. We might see Jazz Lakers in the playoffs. That's worthy of discussion. All things that have to do with actual basketball. And frankly, there's no reason, and I think ratings would suggest people are not interested in, the conversation turning immediately to what about next year? What about games in 2 weeks? What about resting? Because those are the things people are least interested in hearing about.
Right. And look, there's a time and a place for everything. There's 24 hours a day to fill. But in the hour that the game ends, can we at least talk about the damn game? Is what you just said and what I'm saying. And it's just the ability, or the desire to get to what's next so outweighs the what's now that it's kind of driving me nuts a little bit, especially under these circumstances when we had everything that was next taken away from us. And we all agreed, man, when sports comes back, we're going to appreciate it again. Well, that lasted like 5 days. In terms of the way ESPN has gone about covering this, at least with the coverage that I saw them pivot to immediately that the Lakers wrapped up the one seed, does LeBron need to rest? Does AD need to sit? Does da 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 da? You could have spent 15 minutes breaking down that off the dribble step back three dagger from a guy who's 7-1. You had a 7-1 guy shoot a top of the key, step back three, drained it, schwack him over another 7-footer. And it was just, what, that didn't happen? That's not worth talking about?
I think, you know, their ambivalence towards SportsCenter tells you what they think about redoing the game. I'm not defending it, and I'm not saying that you guys are wrong. I'm just saying that they've already established what they think a post-game show should be, because they're always the ones getting hammered by TNT. To me, the only advice I can give is if that's what you're looking for, go to NBA TV because they will do that, and they will do that till you're sick of that. It's just you just have to recognize what ESPN is, what ESPN does, and if it doesn't work for you, move off. And I'm not trying to be sort of dismissive about this. It's just they tell you what they're about all the time. It's about LeBron, and then it's about the Lakers. It's about LeBron, then it's about the game. It's about LeBron, then it's about the other teams. I mean, they've chosen how they want to do this. And being dissatisfied is completely not only within your right, but, you know, well done to you for not taking it. There's at least two other channels that will satisfy your needs. Go to one of them and let ESPN, you know, broadcast to nobody in your house. Or let Jack watch ESPN and let him learn how it's not supposed to be done.
I mean, look, hopefully he's listening right now. Daddy's trying to teach him. But again, if he doesn't have a meter, what good is he? We went over this yesterday. So, do you guys
I want you to say, what good is he? One more time so that Jillian comes in and hits you in the head with a board.
Yeah, no, let's not do that. But, guys, do you remember that when we had prizes to give away because we were close to a prize closet, we're playing the name game? You guys remember the name game, right?
Of course.
So, we haven't played in a while, and we're not playing today necessarily. However,
good promo.
The Los Angeles Clippers have already definitively won the name game more than anyone else. Nash, if you would, please.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for
the name game.
Starring anyone with two first names.
What's your name?
My name?
Dirt first. It's a funny name.
What'd you say his name was again?
His name is Ricky. Ricky Bobby.
Ricky Bobby. He's got two first names.
Now, here's your host with two first names, Damon Bruce.
I cannot stress enough how much we're not playing the name game right now. We're not.
Don't call. Please don't call.
Do not call, and it's not Chris Paul. However, the Los Angeles Clippers have so definitively won the name game now and forever in perpetuity, based on a lineup that they had out on the court just the other night. Do you realize that the Clippers just the other night had a name game participant in every position? Kawhi Leonard, Paul George, Patrick Beverley, Marcus Morris, and Joakim Noah is, I think, maybe the only time in recent history all five guys on the same team have been name game qualifiers.
Reggie Jackson, also a Clipper for what it's worth.
They have six. They have six, but I was really hoping you'd try to figure out a way to get Ivica Zubac in there.
Hey, I don't know. Zubac could be a first name somewhere.
Right, that also, could be Mike, wherever he's from.
Exactly. I would also say, though, it's worth pointing out that the Lakers have very nearly the ability to combat them, so we could actually have a conference finals all-name game team because you got Markieff Morris, Jared Dudley, I guess Bradley's not there, sadly, but he is on the roster. Davis is a first name. Anthony Davis counts. LeBron James and Dwight Howard. So you could definitely get to five Lakers as well.
Just imagine if Steve Blake were still there, the fun that we could be having.
Oh, man. Unbelievable.
Yeah, that'll cure their ratings problems.
George Kontos. He knows an awful lot about pitching, knows an awful lot about being a San Francisco Giant, and we are going to talk to him about the Giants' pitching struggles when we come on back after we say hello to George. We got to talk about one of the bigger debuts the A's have run out in a really long time in terms of a starter. Jesus Luzardo makes his first start for the A's tonight. We are going to look at that. They also saw their bats wake up in Seattle. We'll see if they stay awake for Jesus's first start tonight. But when we come on back, we're talking some Giants and Coors with George Kontos here on 95.7 The Game. And we are, we are brought to you by Radio.com, which is us. We're brought to you by us. Radio.com is where you go. Search 95.7 The Game and add it to your favorite stations. That way you'll be able to listen live no matter where you are to what we're doing. If you missed an interview, if you missed the name game that we were just not even playing, You can rewind and listen. So you can do all that, whether you're at home, your car, or at work. Use the rewind feature anywhere for 24 hours to catch anything you might have missed. 95.7 The Game on radio.com. Damon Ratto and Kolsky, you're on 95.7 The Game.
Back to Damon Ratto and Kolsky on 95.7 The Game.
Welcome, welcome. It's good to have you here, Damon Ratto and Kolsky. And George Kontos, you can see him now, Giants pre and post game on NBC Bay Area. Of course, two of the three World Series. He's got two of those rings. George Kontos, thank you so much for joining us today, George. How are you?
I'm doing great, guys. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you on. Thank you for joining us. Let's get into a topic that we've been kicking around, and then we'll bring in all the other stuff. I don't want to ask you, the guy who's sitting in a studio now or wherever you're doing the show from, since we're not allowed in studios, but I don't want to ask studio George Kontos. I want to ask on the bump George Kontos. Would you want defensive shifts galore behind you? Yes or no?
Well, the honest answer is no. And just to add on to your initial intro, I still feel like I'm pitcher George Kontos in the studio. So that's a good thing, I guess. But as far as the shifts, I think the shifts need to be pitcher specific, and I'm sure they are somewhat. But I was always a guy who I had a pretty big, deep repertoire. I would move the ball around. I didn't rely on just high velocity, trying to blow it by guys and just try to beat them with high octane stuff. I would throw cutters back door. I would throw two seams. The exact play that we saw, in the sixth inning of last night with Johnny, where Brandon was shifted to the second base side of the field, and then he threw a really, really nice pitch, well-executed two-seam, and the result was exactly what, in his mind, I think he was expecting. He missed the barrel of the bat, got a weak ground ball to shortstop, and there was nobody there. So I'm a kind of guy where I'm not a big fan of the shift. I think the shift should not be extreme or put on at all with guys who have movement to both sides of the plate.
And the shift is not something that you dealt with much in your career. It wasn't really in vogue or in fashion then. Bochy, I don't think, shifted anything but a few gears driving to the ballpark.
Well, no, my last couple of years, 16, 15, 16, 17 with the Giants, we were implementing some of the shifts. That's when it kind of started to make it big, big ovation into the game. And I remember I had a play literally in Colorado, very similar to what happened to Johnny last night, except I was facing Daniel Descalzo. I threw him a two-seam fastball down and away, got a routine four-hopper to shortstop, and the coaching staff had shifted panic into the big-time hole and Crawford to the second base side of the bag, and same thing happened. I gave up a routine little ground ball single that should have been out, and the next batter, which luckily for me, Charlie Blackmon, only hit it to the right field wall and not over it. Unfortunately, Johnny didn't have that same luck, but I think the shift just needs to be amplified or managed differently for every person on the mound.
That said, how much do you lose as a pitcher like you were when they put on a shift? Because they're not going to all of a sudden shift for the pitch. They're going to stay where they are. How much of your repertoire as or just say, how much repertoire does a guy who works both sides of the plate lose by having to pitch to a shift that's already static in there?
Well, just to give you an example, my cutter, just to use this pitch, my cutter, when I threw it inside to a lefty, it didn't have lateral movement. It had vertical. So it was more like a hard split when I threw it inside to a lefty. When I threw it back door, it would have more lateral movement. So my cutter was never really used to throw inside on the hands to lefties, but when I was facing a lefty that was shiftable, they would still shift, and then what would happen was I'd throw a backdoor one, and there would be no one at shortstop, where a lefty would typically hit a backdoor cutter off me. So I think that you're always supposed to pitch to your strength. That should never change. The one thing that I did hear Johnny say in his post-game interview is that he didn't really check where the defense was. I have to fault myself for not really doing that as often as I probably should have with guys on base, knowing where Brandon Crawford was or Panic was or whatever. But ultimately, being the pitcher, you're the guy in control. Everything moves off of you. So you have to be comfortable with whatever's going on, and you still have to pitch to your strengths. So if you're going to pitch to your strength, get an outcome that you want, and then there's nobody there, a conversation has to be had somewhere so you can try and rectify that situation.
So I guess the conversation is sort of where I want to attack this from. I feel like someone must have told Johnny Cueto at some point that this is a team that likes to employ a lot of shifts. And then is it his responsibility to check that? And or are maybe we seeing sort of a bit of a push and pull between a veteran player and a young in the game manager where they're sort of fighting about this?
Yeah, I mean, but ultimately, if I'm Johnny Cueto, if I'm a guy who had 13 years in the big leagues, I'm the ace of the staff, I'm the guy who's expected to go out there every fifth day and give our team the best chance to win out of our five starters, I would go in and I would have a conversation. I'd say, hey, look, we have to either shift less when I'm on the mound, or let's try a game where we don't shift at all and see what happens. Because if he's going to go out there and be frustrated and maybe not have confidence in his defense or change the way Johnny pitches, that's not what you want either. But you have to be vocal and you have to be proactive about making sure everybody is in the spot where you want. And to credit the fielders, it's not just the coaches, whoever's in the dugout saying, let's shift here. Brandon Crawford, I know, has free reign. He's a very smart shortstop. He moves with who's up to bat and who's on the mound. He's very good at pretty much being in the general area of where he thinks the ground ball will go. Sometimes he's overruled, and the coaches will be like, look, move further over. But for the most part, it's an effort for everybody. I'd say the middle infielders, the coaching staff, and the pitcher, Johnny, for example, need to sit down and be like, look, we need to get something going because I can't keep getting beat this way.
George Kontos joining us here. You can see him tonight, Giants pre and post game live on NBC Sports Bay Area. How much are you missing your career? You've officially been away from it long enough now to where that itch might be starting to bug you a little bit. It's so funny. We've said that, you know, Buster Posey is so taken for granted that in his absence, you start missing him. There was a point there where it was like everyday Kontos, man. You were as dependable as the day was long. How much are you missing this game now that you don't get to be a guy walking to the hill almost once every other day?
Well, you know, it's funny. I trained this offseason to potentially play, and I was throwing in front of scouts. My stuff had gotten to the point where I thought it was the best that it had ever been. I was throwing, you know, 90, 92 in bullpens, which I had never thrown that hard prior to being in a live game before. And then once I hadn't signed by the day spring training started, I had told myself that that was going to be it. I had reached out to Devin Fox and the NBC Sports Bay Area crew, and I was like, is this an opportunity still? Because we had talked about it all my years playing in San Francisco, and they're like, yes, we would love to have you. And then the pandemic hit, and while it's terrible and it's kind of thrown everything upside down, the one good thing for me, at least, is it had given me some time to just step away and forget about baseball for a few months. And then I even got to missing it. You start seeing some of the Korean baseball that was on, and you start getting the itch again. So right now, not being in studio, not having to go to the ballpark, it's been a little bit easier even to cover it. I think I'm going to have a hard time when, you know, maybe next year when I'm in San Francisco, walk in to cover a game and I walk onto the field and I can't go right in between the white lines. That's going to be a little bit difficult, and I'm sure I've already prepared myself for the emotions that'll come with watching a game live and not being able to play. But, you know, the one thing that I can say is I always prepared, I always worked hard, I always left it on the field. So I can look in the mirror and say that I'm very content and happy with how I left everything off. So do I miss it? Absolutely. Is it something that was a huge chapter of my life? Yes. But this next chapter, I'm very much looking forward to as well.
Well, and you're off to a very good start. Just curious, what do you think put some life on your fastball that you might not have had as you were tinkering going into this year?
Well, what it was is I sat down and I kind of broke down my delivery from the ground up, and I started buying into some of the, you know, kinetic energy transferring stuff, a lot of the things that you see Trevor Bauer and guys like that. Not necessarily the weighted ball stuff. While I did have a weighted ball routine that I would do, I think the most that I got out of it was just kind of getting all the checkpoints in my delivery working together again. I was a guy who kind of would build up some momentum, and I would leak a little bit off the mound. And what that would do is it not let me use all of the strength and power that my legs create. And what I did this year was I tried to make sure my feet were grounded and create a little bit more hip-shoulder separation. I'm sure you guys by now have heard what that means is when your front foot lands, your hips are open, but your shoulders are still closed. And then that torque is what brings all the velocity and spin rate and all that. So I had broke it down to the level of, okay, this is what I need to do. This is what I'm doing. I would do drills to try and get it back to where I thought it needed to be. And I made some pretty good strides. Unfortunately, I was 34 years old, and I wasn't pumping 95 in those bullpens, even though I think that 95 was in the tank this year. I've never been a guy that's had overpowering velocity. I've just been a guy that could go out there, throw strikes, throw breaking balls behind the count, and ultimately, and in my opinion, most importantly, get out.
Yeah, they call that pitching where I'm from, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So you got some mechanical things squared away, and had you been on this team, it might have been your first Giants team that has a ton of offense and needs pitching. And it's never was that way in any of the other years you were there. But what I want to ask is, having spent all that time, do you suddenly have either a different regard for or an interest in becoming a pitching coach?
That's a good question. I've thought about that a lot. I think that I would love to work with players. The thing that I don't know that I would really enjoy doing is going back to the grind of the minor leagues. I totally think that I could do a pitching coach or a bullpen pitching coach role. But those minor leagues traveling on buses and going from hot city to hot city in the Sally League and those really, really hot places, it's just not something that really sounds fantastic to me. But somewhere down the line, could that change? Sure. But I think I would totally like to work with pitchers and maybe one day do a pitching coach position at the big league level.
This is a weird question to ask a guy who played for Bruce Bochy as long as you did, but perhaps other places in your baseball life you can speak to when you might lose some confidence in a manager. Because I honestly, I don't think we know anything really about Gabe Kapler yet, but he has made a couple of mistakes and had a couple apparent breakdowns in communication that make me wonder if there are guys in that clubhouse saying, I'm not a huge fan of this guy. What are the sort of things that lead players to feel that way?
Well, first of all, from the things that I've heard so far about from the clubhouse and in interviews from the guys in there, they love Gabe. They think that he's a great player's manager. His communication is great with them. And the tough part is he steps into a very difficult position being the replacement to a guy who's going into the Hall of Fame and who brought three World Series rings to the city of San Francisco. I'm sure he's under a ton of pressure as well to follow in those footsteps, which are really not fillable. In the, 12 or 13 games that I think, 11 games that they've played so far, it's too small of a sample size, but I mean, throughout the course of a full season, if there are still some of these lack of communications, I think the veteran guys who have been there, Longoria, Crawford, Belt, Hunter Pence, while they would never say so publicly, I think maybe internally you start to question some of the decisions that are maybe being made.
George, how much different was it for you to pitch to Buster Posey as your catcher as opposed to, Trevor Brown when he was backing up Posey?
Well, the thing that I can say is all the catchers that we had in San Francisco while I was playing there, from Buster to Hector Sanchez to Trevor Brown to Andrew Susek, they all were working with Buster on a daily basis. So they understood what went into being a catcher at that level. And Buster is obviously irreplaceable, but when you're following that lead, you tend to kind of jump into those shoes as well, and you learn very quickly. What I saw last night with Johnny and Trump was just some guys who hadn't had that many reps together. When Buster was back there calling the shots, I wasn't even thinking. I was almost on cruise control most of the time. And if I ever did shake, he he knew exactly what fingers to throw down after. It was either a three for slider, or he'd give me the same pitch he just called because he had information from prior in the game where he knew that was the right pitch. And that's how I think you have your best outing, is when you're going out there and you're really not thinking all that much. It's just, it's flowing. You see the signs and you're going, and that's usually how I had my best outing.
That probably would have been helpful if they started to shift this year. So that's one more thing that, that Posey takes off the table by taking care of his family. Is there, as you look at this team, not just now, but going forward, do you see a team that's already transitioning to the next era, or one that's concluding the old one?
I think that I see a team that's definitely transitioning into a new era. You still have some guys that are there that are under contract, and over the past couple of years, there's been a lot of speculation. Is, you know, will Belt be traded? You know, what's going to happen with Buster? You know, I think once Saves and Bobby Evans, once they, their time had kind of, you know, expired, and you brought in the new regime, so to speak, I think that was kind of the closing of the last chapter and the start of a new one moving forward.
As a former relief pitcher, I feel it's important to ask you, where's your head at on the runner on second base in extra innings?
I think it is, you know, that's not a good rule. This is Major League Baseball, you know, so when you get a little bit, Little League-ish, in my opinion, when you start with a guy on second to try and speed the games up. How often do you actually see games that go, you know, 14, 15 innings? It's not very rarely. You know, it's one of those things where we did it in the minor leagues in 2019, last year. I had pitched in the minor leagues in AAA with the Washington Nationals. And, you know, it's a little awkward when you go out to start a new inning and there's a guy on second base. It's almost you know, like a pre-written, you bunt a guy over, then you see what happens, and you try to get a run in, and then you could still have 13, 14 innings because both teams play it the same way unless somebody gets a clutch hit. So I'm not a huge fan of the runner on second rule. I think that the game of baseball was awesome the way it was, and it didn't really need this little extra change.
George, thank you so much for joining us, man. It was great to talk to you. Break a leg on these broadcasts. Root for your Northwestern Wildcats when we got some Big Ten football once again, if we get Big Ten football. And maybe Indiana can take you out. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.
Really, really appreciate it. George Kontos here on 95.7 The Game.
I forgot to bond with him over Evanston. I blew it.
Next time.
Next time we have him,
without
on.
A doubt, you can
talk
share
about
all your
Mustard's Last Stand,
North Shore memories. a text line says Damon does not watch the Giants, so his questions make him look so stupid. He should know Bocci, spelt B-O-C-C-I.
Hey, people know
he should know Bocci used the shift a lot. Okay, the description of Bruce Bocci as used the shift a lot is a completely false statement. Bruce Bochy did not use the shift a lot. He used it reluctantly as it was coming into the game at the tail end of his career. To say Bruce Bochy used the shift a lot is an insult to the word a lot. Come on.
I don't know if it was
reluctant
or not. In
fairness, he might be talking about a different guy.
Maybe. If it's Bruce Bochy?
Oh, yeah. Dude, the Bochy. Maybe.
Bruce Bocci has always been.
Because Bocce Ball is not spelled B-O-C-C-I either. So this somebody else.
Yeah, that's how I would pronounce B-O-C-C-I, though, is also Bocce, just with my extensive Italian knowledge. I think, yeah, Bocce started to bring the shift in towards the end of his career, and I don't know if it was reluctant because he was an open guy, right? Bocce was always open to the analytics. He was always listening to the new ways of thinking about it. But he coached for like 30 years before ever using a shift. So calm down, everybody.
Seriously.
Well, the other thing, too, and I don't want to get into a huge pedantic argument, but when he had the defenses he usually had in the infield, he didn't have to shift much because one of the things he liked was good fielders who had a lot of range in the infield. He had them in San Diego. He had them in San Francisco. It was only the last couple of years when all of a sudden he had to do different things with his lineup. that, you know, that made him more amenable to things that he wasn't comfortable doing under normal circumstances. And that's one of the things that makes a great manager. It's just you adapt to the players you have because they can't adapt to you.
Congratulations to the Oakland Athletics, who waited all the way till the fifth inning of last night to decide to take some serious at-bats in this major league season. The offense got going for the A's last night in the fifth inning. They plated 8 runs, and Chris Davis, who, you know, of course, on the day that I was writing him off as Dunzo, he comes through with 2 hits, 2 RBIs, his first home run of the year, his first couple of RBIs of the year, and he's a player that I like. I hope he can turn it around. I don't know if that's really going to happen. Yeah, thank you so much for proving me wrong. The rest of that team.
On Chris Davis, just while you're on Chris Davis, it was one of those weird things where, you know, he hit twice in that inning. I think it were both in that inning, right? And he got an RBI the first time on a weird little tapper where he basically missed it, but he cued it just enough that the third baseman couldn't get there in time and the runner on third scored. And that, to me, it's kind of like when a 3-point shooter is cold and then they hit a foul shot. Like, that shouldn't help you hit a home run the next time, but sometimes just sort of getting off the schneid, getting that RBI that maybe you didn't totally deserve, suddenly you're like, yeah, I'm Chris Davis, man. And then he hits the home run the next time up.
Totally. If you can't be good, be lucky, and then maybe you can be good the next time around. You got lucky, look good, feel good, play good, and boy, the A's hit like we expect the A's to hit last night. And I really hope that it follows them into tonight's game against the Texas Rangers for 2 reasons. Number one, here comes Lance Lynn to pitch it straight up your ass. I mean, that's what this guy is very good, very underappreciated. And Jesus Luzardo, couple of early runs can go an awfully long way to a guy making his first ever major league start. Luzardo is, I mean, you have to, I don't think there's a single Giant prospect that has been as ballyhooed as Jesus Luzardo. I mean, Bart, everyone included. I mean,
back
Jesus
to
Luzardo,
right?
I think so. I think so. I mean, Jesus Luzardo is the next thing coming, apparently. And tonight, he arrives as a starter. What I also thought was really encouraging last night is if the A's are going to put this together and if they're going to cobble it together because the offense might not be what you hoped it would be, well, now, hey, pitching, what you got? Well, hopefully Luzardo shows you a little something tonight. Frankie Montas last night, very strong. And you can say the Mariners aren't exactly the murderer's row, but he gave up 1 run. He worked 7 innings, which is the equivalent of a complete game these days, and he struck out 9. That's swing and miss stuff. So all of a sudden the A's got a little bounce to them. We'll see tonight if they can take it against the Texas Rangers, who, by the way, can mash. They're good. That lineup is scary.
The lineup's scary, but it's gotten off to a slow start in a lot of areas. And other than Joey Gallo and Shin-Soo Chu, they haven't gotten a lot of traction. The other thing is their pitching's been brutal. So
Joey Gallo hits it. Oh, sorry. Joey Gallo hits it very, very hard. It is.
Yes.
It is something to behold.
Yes. He hits it more frequently than he used to, but he always hits it hard.
Yeah.
He doesn't get cheated.
By the way,
the other thing about Luzardo that will be interesting to see tonight, since you brought him up, he pitches. He's on turn to pitch again Sunday against the Astros, and that's kind of a defining game in a short season, because Houston is the team that most impacts what the A's plan to do this year, because not only is it the team they got to get by in their own division, they've got to be able to play with them in case, you know, the playoffs put them against each other. So I think tonight will be particularly interesting, just if you wanted to watch Luzardo play.
When we come on back, we got a note on Madison Bumgarner that, since he used to be around here, you might be interested in. And the Seattle Seahawks are a team that the Niners have to deal with at least twice a year. And boy, oh boy, oh boy, Seahawks are trying to get even a little bit better than they've gotten already this offseason. And we're going to talk about that when we come on back. We know that the 49ers have already made a few moves. And today, Richard Sherman and Jimmy Garoppolo took the microphone and talked to the press. We will hear a little bit from them. Don't you go anywhere. We are underway. We are still looking forward to talking to all of you for a Tuesday trifecta. Your list of demands will be coming up a little bit later on. We're also going to say hello to Hannibal Thompson, a local comedian who grinded all the way to his own, like, Netflix, Amazon special. Like, he's got a special coming out, man. What a great moment for him. And it's his birthday. So, you know, you add both those together and we can do a little promo for a local kid making good. We're going to talk to him late in the show this afternoon. And we are just, we're rolling, baby. You're invited in right now at 888-957-9570. We're brought to you by Fremont Bank. Full service banking, no compromises.
Damon, Ratto, and Kolsky continues on 95.7 The Game.
A note on Madison Bumgarner, and we're talking some NFL here, but boy, two things that just happened from the bubble that we need to let you know about because these things matter. Number one, look, I don't think Marvin Bagley Jr. has anything to apologize for. He has got a nice NBA career. He is not an embarrassment when he's on the court. But it's embarrassing to think that the Kings selected him in front of Luka Doncic. Marvin Bagley is not even playing right now because of a foot injury, which, you know, again, when you got foot injuries and sprains that are taking you out for the remainder of a year and you still get an offseason built in thanks to a pandemic and he can't come back, that's bad news. Big guys, once feet and knees start going, it's hard to get it back. And he is very early in his career with major foot problem. Which they, you know, they'll tell you everything's going to be fine. Here's what'll never be fine. You didn't draft Luka. And Luka tonight just put it on the Sacramento Kings like they stole his bicycle. In an overtime win, Luka has a 30-point, 20-rebound, 10-assist game. There have only been four of those since the NBA-ABA merger. They screwed that up. I mean, yep. And it was kind of easy to see it coming. I mean, it really, really was. Luka had every single be comfortable betting on him that an indicator could throw at you from Europe. And they didn't bet on Luka, who tonight, let me give you the exact box. Luka played 44 minutes, shot 50%. He had 34, 20, and 12. Two blocks. Six turnovers, but, you know, he's being asked to do an awful lot. Luka Doncic will win multiple MVPs. You know, Baggerly's giving you about 15 a night. Luka's going to give you 30 a night. I mean, it's why some teams are called the Sacramento Kings. It really is.
In fairness.
There is no fairness.
Never mind fairness. There's no fairness here. They picked Bagley because he said he wanted to play in Sacramento because the money was better. Because he would be slotted higher in the draft. The fact is, this is one of those moments where Sacramento leads with its face because it always wants guys who want to, you know, commit to the town. And sometimes the difference in talent doesn't allow you to do that. And everybody agreed that Luka Doncic was a significantly better player. And the fact that they were sort of influenced by Doncic's father saying, gee, I don't know if we want to play in Sacramento. I mean, I think we saw that in the Stephen Curry draft, where they were hinting pretty heavily that they wanted to be picked by the Knicks. And the Warriors said, well, you may want to get picked by the Knicks, but they're going to have to get our pick because we're staying where we are and we're taking you. So, I mean, it's to count the number of ways that Sacramento screwed that up and enhanced its reputation as Sacramento. The fact is, they went into that draft scared, and they got what they deserved.
Yeah. Yeah, sadly, that's the case.
That is wonderful analysis. It really, yeah.
I mean, there's not much I can add, right?
I'm not even trying to be funny. That is the correct response. Yeah, they blew that. And all it's going to cost them is the entirety of Luka Doncic's already preordained first ballot Hall of Fame career. I mean, he's going to have to get involved in like a 7-car pileup to not make the Hall of Fame.
Yeah,
that's
and as you kind of said at the beginning, it stinks for Marvin Bagley. It's not his fault. You know, he has a chance to still be a productive NBA player. He has no chance to be as good as Luka Doncic. Just none, again, barring some sort of calamity.
He is this generation's Sam Bowie.
Luka went 3 in that draft to Atlanta, who, remember, flipped the pick. The guy who went 4th in that draft today is out of the bubble. Jaren Jackson Jr. has suffered a meniscus tear in his left knee. He will miss the remainder of this season. The Memphis Grizzlies showed up not ready to dance in the bubble. They're now 0-3, I believe. And that is a bad injury. That is the tough one. And all of a sudden, you know, holding on to an 8 seed for Memphis is nothing guaranteed. And I'll tell you, I love me some Ja Morant. How Ja Morant's supposed to do this by himself, I do not know.
Yeah, that stinks because that's another really good young player. The good news is meniscus usually is not a super long-term injury, so you'd hope next season he'll be back. But
it's an outpatient surgery.
Yeah, but that leaves them short for even if they hold on to the 8th seed, you know, by less than 4 games, going to be a tough spot for them to win what amounts to a playoff game against one of the other teams because he's their second-best player.
Yeah, for the right to play the Lakers.
Have fun with that. Have fun with that.
I don't know if you guys saw this, but there's a story out of Fort Collins, Colorado, about the Colorado State Athletic Program. And this is from complaints by athletes and staffers that coaches have told players not to report COVID symptoms, threatened players with reduced playing time if they quarantine. And they also claim that CSU is altering contact tracing reports to keep players practicing.
Wow. This is why we can't play college football. Because
sounds
can't
like a lot of people
these...
are about to get fired.
Absolutely. I hope so. But you can't trust these creeps. Period. The dudes that have been exploiting college football players for so long don't know how to do anything but exploit them. We cannot trust them. They will not take care of these kids.
Yeah, and it's interesting that the Pac-12, which has a potential players' revolt happening, according to Bomani Jones, who talked with us yesterday, most of the coaches have been good with this. And there's just a massive difference between guys who get it, even if only for their own survival, and guys who don't.
I tell you what, since you just brought
Steve Adazio just got to Colorado State.
That's not an impression you want to make.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. I'm sorry to cut you off there. But since you just brought this up, let's just capitalize on the topic you put on the table. You mentioned Bomani joined us yesterday, not to talk about Colorado State and whatever the hell is happening there right now, but to talk about the list of demands that Pac-12 players have put together and put forward saying we need these lists, we need these demands met if we're going to be playing college football for you. And it all started over a group text where they basically said, all right, here's the protocols on our campus. They talked to a kid on another campus, and that kid would say, well, those aren't our protocols at all. How are you going to safely travel here to this game if we're doing two different things? And players started talking to each other. Social media has created an ability to have a massive groupthink conversation, which is leading to, again, a list of demands. Bomani Jones joined us yesterday. Nash, if you've got this, cut one. Bomani Jones, I was just told we don't have it.
Let me jump in and say one thing.
It's on the cut sheet, but it's not there. But never mind. So anyways, Bomani Jones basically said that he was very impressed by the players that he talked to in the Pac-12. They seemed to be, you know, a smart group that basically got together to talk about COVID-19 safety. And then that pivoted to another topic of equality, which is obviously the Black Lives Matter topic. And then you can't talk about equality without immediately pivoting to where the money goes. Because where the money, there's nothing that tells you who's more equal to everyone than everyone else than the money, right? And they basically said, you know what this is? This is a redistribution of wealth off of the sweat of predominantly Black kids. You are getting huge paydays for predominantly white schools with predominantly white head coaches making the lion's share of the money and little opportunity for players to make a buck, jump back in as a coach to have a career. And, I mean, if COVID-19 has done anything, it has shown us that anything that calls itself an amateur sport has really been a professional sport all along. And that even almost goes to, like, Little League stuff. It really does. There are a lot. There are enough people making serious money off of Little League that you could say, in a weird way, that's sort of a professional sport for, maybe not for the kids. They're not making any money, but there's a lot of grown-ups making money from Little League baseball, Babe Ruth baseball. Here's Bomani's cut. Look at that, a little hustle, and we got it. Way to go,
guys. I was impressed by really the courage of it, and they spoke very clearly. Like, nobody that I talked to sounded wishy-washy at all about the issues at play. And it's going to take a lot for them to get it, you know, get all the way through to the idea of not playing games at a certain point or not practicing. Like, that's going to take a lot. But I thought that they had a real solid grasp of some pretty complex ideas, and they understood how the machine worked that they were part of. The other thing that's worth noting is there is a significant Caucasian presence in this movement, not just in participation, but in the development and the recognition of the larger ideas. And the big thing that everybody I talked to has had to say about this movement was front and center was racial justice. Like, there's a very tangible COVID concern that the players have. But the number one issue that they believe needs to be addressed by this conference and by collegiate sports in general are those of racial justice.
So Bomani Jones shared with us yesterday, Ray.
Yeah. You know, I think kids are finally understanding the lessons that the players at Missouri taught 4 years, 5 years ago, when they refused to play because of the Ferguson riots. And it is that you can't control labor that won't do labor. And at some point, you have to listen to what their concerns are. And it's almost, I mean, you almost fall into the trap of saying it's more noble because they're arguing about health and safety and human dignity issues. But the one thing that the NC2A, well, the member schools of the NC2A, because the NC2A clearly has no control over each school. They just, they're sort of like, they're like an ATM. They take in all the money and then they spit it out in different directions. But every school has its own rules, and some schools don't have any rules, and the rules they have, they very often don't even honor them because ultimately it's about them protecting the one thing that is most important to them, which is the flow of income. And if you have players saying no, that is the flow of income.
Matt, before you weigh in, let me welcome you to your 4 o'clock hour.
You're listening to 95.7 The Game, KGMZ FM and HD1 San Francisco, a radio.com sports station.
I think one of the things that's interesting about this, and we didn't have time for me to get this to Bomani, but I do wonder how much of this is a sort of unrepeatable case, thanks in part to the educational institutions that are Cal Berkeley and Stanford. I don't think it's a coincidence that the guys who seemed to be the most active participants, or at least a good percentage of the guys who seemed to be the most active participants in organizing this, were Cal and Stanford students. I don't think it's a coincidence that those are two of the most academically sound and respectable Power Five schools that exist. I mean, it's what? Those two, maybe Northwestern, Vanderbilt. It's a very short list of Power Five schools.
Let me support your point. You said Northwestern, where the concept of should we form a union and strike was sort of born a few years ago, didn't take off, but it's where the conversation was had. And who has been the most alert, let's shut it down because sports don't matter nearly as much as our safety group of athletes in America today? Ivy League athletes. The Ivy League waved off the NCAA tournament and the concept of playing football faster than anyone else.
And
you know,
I think
what do we
having,
accuse them of? Of being smarter than anyone else. Cal,
that's right.
Stanford, your point made perfectly.
And I think that that's a benefit that the Pac-12 has that, I don't know. I mean, none of the other Big Ten schools seemed to react when Northwestern did what they did a couple years ago. And that may have been circumstantial, but I don't know that you could create this sort of student momentum on its own without some really high-level students being a part of it. Because if you read Bomani's article, part of the key here is that a couple of the guys who were at the center of organizing this are like students of labor wars past. These are guys who have studied at a high academic level what labor organizers have historically done with success. So it's a special group of kids that got this rolling.
Well, on the other hand, though, people who may not view Missouri as a group, you know, in with Cal and Stanford and the Ivy Leagues for brainy operations, they're the kids who actually use their bodies and just said, we are not going to work. And their coach, Gary Pinkel, backed them up on it, and it eventually got the president of the university fired because he reacted.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.